I want y'all to give a hand to DJ Pro V. Give my hand. I also like to thank Archive Montreal, Canadian Heritage, CKUT, and Louise Burns for making this event possible. Please give them a hand. We're here today to talk with someone who's an innovator, a go-getter, a hustler. He's put over 30 years of blood, sweat, and tears into the urban scene in Montreal and Canada. He bleeds burgundy because he's from Little Burgundy. Mesdames et messieurs, ladies and gentlemen, welcome the mayor of Montreal, Mr. Ricky D. Thank you, Shai. Thank you for that. Mayor of Little Burgundy.
Oh, the mayor of Little Burgundy, Montreal. Which one?
Little Burgundy. From a long time ago.
All right.
I was given that from just doing my grind and seeing what always repping my neighborhood and where I came from, which was always very important to me because I felt like where you came from is definitely where you want to go and where you're going to end up being at. So, Little Burgundy, born and raised down there, it shaped a lot of my desires and what I wanted to be today.
Okay, cool. Now, also, another very important person in your life was your grandmother.
Oh, let me even, before we even get into that,
all right.
I just wanted, like, you know, thank CKUT for thinking of me on this. This came as a total surprise, totally from the left field. I never thought that anybody would even consider me in that mix, and I appreciate them giving me the opportunity. I also like to thank my family, my wife, and my two kids who have shaped me and molded me into the man that I am today, who's helped to give me the strength in order to continue to do what I do. I like to, you know, thank those and then thank all of my friends and everything, which through the course of my conversation, you might hear a name or two come up in the mix.
All right. So another person that was very instrumental in your life and your upbringing was your grandmother.
That's right.
Mrs. Daly.
That's right.
From Montserrat.
That's right. I grew up in Little Burgundy. My mother was a single mom. She had me when she was 18 years old. You know, back in the 60s, my father happens to be Italian. My mother's from the Caribbean, so some people always wonder, well, what's this guy? He looks Spanish, he looks Arab, he looks this, he looks... They couldn't figure me out. You know, I was like international, which is cool, you know what I mean? But that's where I came from. That's how I came about. I grew up down there.
Tell us the things she instilled in you and your grandmother.
Oh, well, still. Hard work.
All right.
She came from the Caribbean, and when she came to Canada, she came on what's called the domestic program.
Okay.
In the 1940s, late 40s, 50s, they were bringing black people from the Caribbean in order to do domestic work in the rich people's houses here in Canada. Because
yes,
back then, everybody was coming off the war, there was a lot of money, a lot of white people didn't want to clean toilets, so they brought in the black folks, and she was one of them that came up. My grandfather on my mother's side also was in the Merchant Marines.
Okay.
He came up in the mid, after the war was over, looking for new opportunities in order to raise his soon-to-be family.
So let's talk about basketball and music. Growing up, you were someone who loved basketball. At a young age, you carried your basketball everywhere you went. You were hanging out with guys like Michael McLean, Peter Balfour, Trevor, Wayne. You guys were playing basketball back and forth. Everywhere Ricky D went, he had his basketball. He was dribbling his basketball all over the hood.
I had two things.
And a ghetto blaster.
That's right.
Yeah, big ghetto blaster. If you guys haven't seen Spike Lee's movie, Do the Right Thing, Radio Raheem, Ricky D was our version of Radio Raheem, a Little Birdie, with his big goggles. He had on the basketball goggles. So how did music and basketball save you from the streets?
Well, you know, it gave me an opportunity. I always loved music. I always loved basketball because it was the two vehicles that, you know, empowered me and gave me confidence to go out there and meet people, right? You know, being shy, Coming from a neighborhood like, you know, where everybody was, you know, basically putting Little Burgundy down and seeing that, you know, number crackhead, number drug dealers, number this, that, pimps, this, that. But there was also hardworking families who, you know, took the value of education and took the value of hard work and took it to another level. And, you know, some made it out, which I wish they would have stayed, because if you all know what Little Burgundy is today, you would see, right? You know, you got million-dollar condos down there. You got these affluent, you know, people that moved into the neighborhood.
Yeah.
I wish they would have stayed and not saw that they needed to leave the neighborhood to go elsewhere to finally say they made it.
Yeah. Well, it's unfortunate we didn't have that guidance, right?
Yeah. You know, that's what happens. You know, a lot of growing up, we didn't have a lot of mentors.
Exactly.
A lot of people showing us the way to succeed. So a lot of it was hit and miss. A lot of it was just trying to figure out what, you know, how to make it out.
Now, you mentioned it. Sorry about that. You mentioned the importance of education, and you were the first person from your family to receive a bachelor's from McGill in urban planning, right?
That's right.
All right. Give him a hand.
Got
a bachelor's in urban planning.
Yeah. Urban systems,
I have a question for you. How did that bachelor's build your confidence, and what were you planning to do with that bachelor's?
Well, you know, when I was coming up as a teenager, you know, trying to find myself, you know, I got caught up in a lot of different things. Some things were good, some things were bad. Basketball and music basically kept me on the right track while I was exploring some of these negative elements out there. And by doing this, I eventually built into things, right? And, you know, you built your confidence. I was going to school. I got kicked out of one school, went to another school. And then when I came back to the original school I was at Westmount High.
Okay.
I got kicked out of Westmount High.
Okay.
Because I was involved in breaking into the cafeteria.
Okay.
We stole a whole bunch of chocolates and chips. And then we sat up there and we moved it downstairs into a locker and we were selling them downstairs in the basement back to the students. You know, they eventually figured out I was one of the guys in it. So in grade 9, they told me, okay, you can go. You know, so we don't want you here no more. All right, cool. Went to LaSalle. Was down in LaSalle doing my thing down there. LaSalle Protestant High School. And that was a trip. Because it was just a different environment, right? You know, I grew up in hip-hop with, I don't even know what to call that music, like groups like U2 and Big Country. So I was in that kind of, I was between hip-hop and
Big Country.
Yeah, the New Age type thing.
I was
in that alternative hip-hop scene. And then when I went to LaSalle, you know, you had the reggae crowd, you had the heavy metal crowd. I wasn't neither one of those. So it was hard for me to fit in because I didn't really understand where I belonged in that situation.
Okay.
So I went there. I did a year and a half, though 2 years. Failed French. I was really bad in French.
Like a lot of people.
But I failed French. I went back to Westmount High, and that's when I really started to change my life. And I went there, and there was a teacher there. His name was Garvin Jeffers. He was
Mr. Jeffers.
Yeah, he was in charge of the Black History, and he was also a teacher in mathematics. And he signed a paper for me.
Nice.
Basically saying that if I messed up, it was his name on the line. So that's when I decided to change my life. And that's when I became like, your basketball coach, Vince, and then I was doing technical drawing. I was playing basketball too, and it just gave me confidence, right? And I went from a guy who couldn't achieve anything, I couldn't even finish a season before that, to where I started to accomplish things. And that gave me the confidence.
And you also won a national championship with Dawson College.
I won provincial championships with the team I was with at Westmount High. Then I went to Dawson. I won a AA championship provincial, and then won the national championship in the AAA basketball.
Okay, cool. Let's talk about the influence Little Burgundy had in the 80s in the music scene, because Little Burgundy was a big hub for urban music. Everyone on the South Shore, West Island, NDG, LaSalle were hanging in Little Burgundy. You had guys like Prince Charles, The Wizard of Oz, Kickin' Fabian Ash, Dr. Jam. They were like the front DJs back then. Describe to us that whole music scene in Little Burgundy and how it really grasped you.
Okay, well, you know, during that time, I was influenced from a lot of people. And one of them is in the room, Butcher T.
Okay.
Butcher T's mother used to own a hair salon downtown.
Okay, I didn't know
so
that.
I used to go by and check him out. You know, he was always hanging in Burgundy, you know. and he was my dude. So him, guys like DJ Ray, who ended up being, you know, a reggae artist, but started off in hip-hop. Them two guys started doing Club 980 with Mike Williams. So they had the first urban radio show in Canada.
Wow.
So, and during that time, I was going with my mother and with some of my friends, and we were going down to New York for Labor Day, picking up the music, picking up the energy, buying records, you know, 7 inches, and playing them, and getting to know hip-hop. So, you know, I was always hanging around. I was always around, right? I couldn't dance, I couldn't rap, I couldn't sing. Couldn't do any of that. I tried.
You are a stiff dancer.
You know, and like, you know, all my friends were like, how could I say it? Oh, you know, they were into that. So I wanted to be involved in this. How am I going to get in this business, you know? How am I going to do this? So I decided I was going to go more to the business side of things.
Okay.
And, you know, and start to hand out flyers and get to know people all across the city. I was one of the first guys to start to go and, you know, do the handing out at the movie theaters. Mm-hmm. Back then, Little Burgundy, among other neighborhoods, NDG, LaSalle, Côte des Neiges, we were the guys, and the ladies also, the girls too, that brought hip-hop into Montreal.
True.
There was guys that were older than me that were, you know, there. Unfortunately, they're no longer here anymore doing their thing. They either passed away, or they, you know, went on to other things, moved away, or they just moved away from the music itself, right? Some have managed to continue and are still relevant to a certain degree, but most of them faded away. But these were the neighborhoods. It was about 4 or 5 neighborhoods where the music was being played in the dance halls. And back then, black and white kids were coming together because if you wanted to get this music, you had to come into these neighborhoods together. It wasn't as convenient as coming up here or going anywhere else in the East or Laval, South Shore. I've been in the South Shore. They had, you know, the South Shore Black Community Center down there. They were doing some things down there. Yeah, so, you know, Donald D, that is. He was around back then, too, doing this thing. So that, you know, all these neighborhoods, along with Little Burgundy, were critical in helping the music to get out there. They were the first ones to take it into the neighborhoods and embrace it.
Okay. Let's talk about you becoming a party promoter. You started handing out flyers. What was your first party that you promoted?
Oh,
and how much money did you make?
Well, wow. My first party I promoted, I was about 16, 17 years old. I was very tall for my age back then, so I used to sneak into the clubs.
He's the same height as he was at 16.
Right, but back then I was slim, I looked tall, and I was able to, and then I had a lot of older friends who worked the nightclubs at security. So they would let me in, even though they knew I was underage, and I got an opportunity to be, I was a little bit more advanced than those at my age were at that time. So I was going into the clubs, and my best friend at that time was a guy named Fabian, and he lived in the same city house that I lived in, lived upstairs with me. And he was a DJ, and he had a partner named Fitz. But Fabian didn't want to hand out flyers.
He wasn't handing out no flyers.
Fabian
was a star back then.
He just wanted to do his thing, and go up there and DJ and get the girls and all of that. Yeah. And that was my introduction to it. Okay. So I started handing out flyers for these guys doing my thing.
And they were called Fitz and Fabian back then.
Right. They were called Fitz and Fabian. And they were like the downtown promoters, you know, okay. Everybody. Keith and Karen was NDG, Spec 2, okay. NDG. And then you had other people from other neighborhoods doing their thing. So they were the downtown promoters. They basically controlled downtown in terms of St. Catherine, around De La Montagne, you know, Crescent, and those areas. Because back then, hip-hop wasn't being played there. It was dance, it was house. The only time you would hear this music was on long weekends or holidays, where the clubs would allow us to go in and rent their spot and do our thing. So that's how it all began. So I was handing out flyers.
Name some clubs for us.
Oh man, it's just Monsard was one. PJ's with another Butcher T used to play at PJ's. So we used to get that place. It was the Rendezvous, Twilight Zone. Around that area. Some of them were on St. Catherine. Rendezvous was on St. Catherine. PJ's was off Peel Street. I can't remember all of them.
It was Checkers too, right?
Yeah, Checkers were starting to come around in the mid-80s. They were coming around, but they were more towards the plateau. They were on Mount Royal and Park Avenue. They were there, across the street from the gas station.
Okay. So when did you do your own Ricky D party? Was that at Rockefeller's?
Well, what happened is that I was, you know, handing out flyers for these guys, becoming very successful at what I was doing. And people were recognizing me for my work. They actually thought I was either Fabian or Fitz because that's how good I was. Yeah. I was sitting on the movie theaters. I was walking up and down St. Catherine, handing flyers, going to all the parties, all the hip-hop parties, giving them the R&B, the reggae parties, just giving them out.
Working hard,
just building the building. Because back then, there was no internet. You had to get out and put your name in the game. That's how it worked. And that's how it's always going to work as far as I'm concerned. But you had to put the work in. So I would go to all these places, do my thing. I eventually started getting popular. I wasn't making any money back then because I was getting paid $100 by Fitz and Fabian. And they were making a lot of money doing this. But it didn't matter. I was happy. I had a sense of belonging, which was important for me coming up as a teenager, to be involved in something successful. So for me, the money wasn't important. It was more of the accomplishment of being involved in something and building my confidence that, you know, hey, maybe this light-skinned boy from Little Burgundy can do something, you know? And it's not like, oh, well, you know, you ain't meant to do nothing. You ain't shit. Relax. You know, let me go in your corner, smoke some weed, get high, forget the world. That's what it's about. And I said, you know, maybe I can do this thing. So eventually, guys like Gary T came to me. Gary T was a critical guy, him and a guy named Ronnie Love, because they saw my talent and they saw my abilities to do this. And they decided that they were going to give me an opportunity. They said, hey, you know, you're filling up these rooms. Because they knew who was filling up the rooms, right? The parties and everything else.
Who, Ricky T?
I was one of the guys that was instrumental in doing that. I wasn't the only guy, but I was one of the key guys. So they sat up there and they said, hey, well, why don't you, you know, come and work with me?
Okay.
And I'm like, okay, cool. So in about 85, 86, it's blurry. I think it's more 86, but it could be 85. Gary invited me to do Run DMC.
Okay.
So I'm like, he said, you know,
you're a partner there, or you're just
no, I'm a partner. I'm a partner in this. I'm like, he recognized what I had to deliver. So he came to me and he basically said, you know, you got a few dollars, come on. So I said to him, you know, I don't really have any money because I was only getting $100 a party, right? So I had, you know, basically $100, even though it was a little bit more than what it is today, still wasn't enough to get me in the game alone. So he basically fronted the money for me.
Okay.
And said, don't worry, I'm going to take care of it. You just go out there and do you. Go out there and grind it.
Yeah.
So I went to work. So we did this. It was a snowstorm. Run DMC, we never thought we were doing that well, 1234 nightclub, which is now the Sank, but 1234. We didn't think these guys were going to make it. Like, imagine, back then you had no cell phones, you had nothing, right? Once they left New York,
praying.
You just waited to see them.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you couldn't call them on the phone. Yo, where you at? Where you at? The text, where you at? None of that, right? They just... So we're sitting there. It's so heavy, heavy, heavy. We're like, man, is that they coming? Place is packed. So we're like, fuck, it's going to be right up in here. They don't show up. So now 12:31, 1 o'clock comes. Guess who shows up?
Run.
Run DMC. They came in there. They ripped it up. It was off the chain. It was bananas. I couldn't believe how live it was. So then that was over. Then we all went to Harvey's afterwards. So we went there to see the Harvey's, right? You know, there used to be one on the corner of St. Catherine and Drummond. And, you know, we brought them there afterwards. And all the hanger-ons came out. Mm-hmm. And that was basically my first taste of doing hip-hop. And then another guy came to me named Ronnie Love. He said, man, I just saw what you just did with, you know, Gary T. Would you like to do this girl named Sybil, who sings this song called Don't Make Me Over, Don't Make Me Over. Anyway, that was a big record back then, right? She was a British girl, heavy set, big girl. And we did it at the Metropolis, sold it out.
Wow.
And then...
This is what, late 80s now?
About 87.
Okay.
Ish, maybe around that. I'm not sure. I'm not good at timelines.
But okay.
It's around that. And so we were there doing our thing. And she grabbed me and she wanted to make out with me, but I was terrified. Any woman that was my height, I was scared. You know what I mean? I was like, yo, you're a little too tall for me. I don't know if I can handle you. So I flew. Like, you know, I said, Bobby, I got a dope man. She's like, where's that guy? Where's that cute guy? And I'm like, Rocky's calling me. Yo, come. I'm like, nah, I'm done. So, did that, brought me in, did that show there, and then I got, it empowered me. It gave me a sense of that I could do things.
So at this time, are you still working with Pitts and Fabian, or are you on
your own? Yeah, I'm still working with them.
Okay.
And I'm getting frustrated with them.
Okay.
Because they're not like...
They're not paying you properly.
They're not paying me, not treating, you know, respecting my grind and not respecting my energy on that. But I still continue to work with them because I was loyal and I believed in loyalty, you know, before I believed in money.
Now, the first time you branched on your own as a full-fledged party promoter, was that when you did Rockefellers?
No, Rockefellers, like, it's funny, right? But a lot of these places... Back in the 80s and the early 90s, I just had a knack for finding locations.
Yeah.
Because when Fabian was at home chilling with some girl or DJ and doing mixtapes, I was on the streets. I was all up in those clubs. I was looking for new locations.
Yeah.
So I was bringing them a lot of the locations, but Rockefellers was one that they did. Yeah, they did Rockefellers. I eventually... we did this party together, and it was at this warehouse. It didn't work well between us. And this was a time when I actually became a partner with them. Didn't work well. So I decided that it's time for me to move on.
Okay.
So I found a partner. His name was Gilbert, and he was from Kenya.
He's a student here, right?
Yeah, he was a student. He used to have a bookstore. And he was my first partner.
That's right.
And we started doing these parties together at a place called Crystal, down on Crescent Street. And it was, yo, we were just filling it up. And that's how we did that. Then a couple of years later, he got tired of Montreal. He didn't see any real opportunities. His bookstore wasn't really working. And he decided that he was going to go to Toronto. Which then I ran into a young guy named Shahid. And we started doing some things together. And we started building some amazing events. And we continued to do our stuff. But Shahid wasn't into producing shows. didn't have the stomach for it. But I loved it. I loved the risk, and I loved to go out there and get it.
So let's talk about that. People think doing shows as a promoter is just a hobby, but there's a lot that goes into it. You got to deal with the Morale Squad sometimes, and you got to deal with the border, customs, you got to deal with management, you got to deal with the agent. Talk to us about the trial and tribulation when putting together a show. But it's not easy. It's a lot of hard work and stress.
No, it was, you know, when we were first started doing these shows, we had no clue that there was even a border between us. Yeah. We were just booking these artists on the strength of they'd be able to come through with ease. And, you know, we ended up having some disasters where guys didn't make it through because they had criminal records. You know, hip-hop was always a music of, you know, the streets. And the streets, sometimes you got people that have criminal records for whatever reasons or not, but it doesn't negate their talent and their ability to perform. But they just get caught up in some of that street life, and, you know, they're not able to get through. So, you know, that was a major thing for us, because we didn't really understand that. We just loved the music. We loved the vibe. We loved the energy. We loved how it brought different communities into the room together, just like we have today, you know? Like, there's all kinds of people coming in just trying to experience, you know, this phenomenon they call hip-hop.
So talking about criminal records and border headaches, tell us about your encounter with B.I.G., the late Biggie Smalls at the Plattsburgh border.
Well, we have so many like stories like that, but what happened with that one is that my man Gary T approached me and said, "Yo, you want to do the show, Biggie Smalls?"
Yeah, he was hot back.
I'm like, "No, but you know what? I didn't know he was hot."
Okay.
So I was like, "Biggie Smalls, who's that?" I'm like, "Oh yeah." I'm like, "No, I don't want to do it. I don't know who this guy is. I'm not putting no money into it. I don't know him." He's like, "You sure?" I'm like, "Yeah, I'm sure." So he decided to produce the show. He was doing it at a place called The World, which then became a Coliseum. It was on the corner of St. Catherine and Mount Cam in the gay village. And show sold out.
Yeah, lineups for glory.
It was sold out. Like, I was like, fuck, I knew I should have won that one. I was like, all right, cool. So, you know, I'm just, like anything, a citizen, doing my thing. So then I get a phone call from Gary. And he said, "Ricky, I need you to go to the border."
This one, they won't. They have cell phones now, right?
I don't know with cell phones.
Like pagers?
Yeah, Pedro. Or he called me at home from the... The name of the club back then was called The World. And he called me from there. And he told me that Biggie can't get in. Can you go and see what's going on? So what had happened to make the story, like, he came to Canada twice before. He went to Toronto and sold out. I didn't know this, because if I knew that, I would have jumped in. But I didn't know this, and he came to Canada, he went to Toronto. A friend of mine, we used to call him, that was his name, I didn't make it up, just call him Tony Burnface. And he did the show. He had no security in the place. The people were the security. So aspiring rappers took the mic out of Biggie's hands and started freestyling. So Biggie came down with a friend. So they backed out of the door and they left, promising that the next time they come to Canada, they're going to bring their crew, their boys. So they got to the border. They got strip searched. They got you name it. Some of the band members that came, because we're going to have a band. And we're going to get deported back to Dominican Republic because there were illegals living in the U.S. These fools, they realize you're crossing the border and you're not supposed to be going into Canada. So they were going to get deported. They brought the dogs on. They did everything. It was a mess.
He had a tour bus, right?
He had a tour bus. He was at the Lacolle border. So then they went to the Super 8 Motel on near Plattsburgh. So I drove down there with two girls. I said, "You know, I'm going to bring two girls down and see if we can entice them." Right? You know what I mean? Biggie, I got these girls, man. Come on, let's go. You don't need the guys. You don't need them. Just bring your own manager. We could. So now we get to Super 8. I go and I speak to his road manager, a big guy. He had like a stitch is going from here from a shotgun blast, and no shirt on with heavy tattoos. I was scared out of my mind. I'm like, what the hell am I dealing with here? Okay, so then we go in his room, we're talking to him. He pages the manager. The manager calls back the hotel room. I get on the phone and I basically ask the manager, you know, listen, I've got some girls here. We have a sold out show. They're waiting. Canada's waiting. Come on, let's do this. He's like, I don't think Chris is going to want to go. He said, I said, come on, let's try. Let's do this. So he said, I don't think he's going to want to go. But if you want to try, all right. So he tells the road manager. The road manager takes me to his door, knocks on the door. Here comes Biggie. Opens the door. Big guy.
6'3".
About that tall,
yeah.
Huge. And I saw a girl in the back had blonde hair, not realizing that was Faith Evans because she wasn't known yet, you know? And I said to him, listen, you know, I got a few girls here. He said, you know, it's sold out. Let's do this. So he looked at me basically and he said, fuck Canada. And he slammed the door in my face. So I said, all right, okay. So I go back to the room, I call the world, and I tell Gary. And I said, Gary, I'm not coming. I'm going straight home. So he was like, okay. So he put the phone down, and then they ride it, they smash cars. It was a mess.
Yeah.
So that's as close as Biggie's ever gotten to Montreal.
So let's talk about concerts that you did that you're grateful for, that were amazing, that were beyond your expectations.
Man, I had so many that were amazing. Public Enemy was one.
Okay.
That was crazy. James Lane. Again, Gary T. He was just, you know, my life wouldn't have been the same at that time because without him, I wouldn't be who I am today. I owe a huge, you know, shout out to him.
So let's shout out Gary. Give him a hand, Gary T. Gary T.
He's not a shy guy. That's why he didn't want to come, but he gave me his blessings. Told me, oh, I'm not coming. Okay. He's not a guy who's, well, if he's around, he's super fun, super energetic, but he's not a guy who's going to be on stage. He's not a guy who's like to talk on the radio. He likes to, you know, just do his grind. What did you ask me?
Oh, what were the concerts that were beyond your expectation, the great show?
Oh, The Roots.
Mm-hmm. Where was that?
I had the pleasure of doing this with District 6, which is a guy named Victor and Andre, and we did it at the Savoy in the Metropolis. It's a small room, and knew really nothing about them, knew a bit, you know. And they came and they put on one of the greatest hip hop shows I've ever seen in my life. It was like a 2-hour long show with Black Dot and with Razelle, and it was crazy, like unbelievable. And we knew right after that they were going to be a force. They were going to be a force, you know. So that was one. The Fugees was another.
That was the first time they came?
Yeah, I did them the first time with Spearhead, okay. Which was Michael Franti. I think it was Michael. It could have been Michael Franti and the Disposable Hypocrisy of Hip Hop. I can't remember. But then it became Spearhead, or was Spearhead with Ben Harper.
Okay.
It was these three together. And the Fugees was the opening act.
Wow, that's a long time ago.
And I remember sitting there talking to them with Wyclef and them and with Dice B. Dice B was at a lot of those shows. I don't know why, but I always remember seeing this guy at all of them. He was just totally on it, you know. And we were just talking with them. That was a great show they did. That's when they had vocab. Then I brought them back with them and the Roots and Goody Mob at the Metropolis. That's when they had the Score album. And they did, yeah. So we did, you know, we had that show. That show was amazing. I almost got into a fight with Lauryn Hill's manager because Lauryn Hill was very difficult. She was not easy. What happened, she told me, It was sold out. It was rammed, rammed. Back then, Metropolis didn't care about capacity. Rammed. Like over 3,000 people. Goody Mob didn't get across the border. It was the Roots, the Fugees, and then the Fugees, Wyclef brought Destiny's Child. I didn't know who Destiny's Child was. I saw these girls there with the mother and the father. They were the chaperones, but I didn't know, right? I'm like, well, why are you guys here? They're like, well, they're 16, 17 years old or 15, something like that. They were underage. And they had to have a chaperone. And that was the first time I met Destiny's Child.
Because Wyclef had produced a song for it.
Yeah. They did No, No, No.
Okay.
That was a big record back then, so he introduced them to the market. And what happened with Lauryn Hill is Lauryn told me, you can have the people go on the speakers. So I said, okay. Security. It was that pack that they had to go on the speakers. Then the manager comes to me and like says, what the hell are you doing? You're not supposed to do that. And I'm like, yo, go talk to Lauryn. And he went and got into me. Obviously, he didn't go talk to her. He's terrified of her. Right? So he didn't want to get in that. You're fired. You know, he didn't want to hear that.
Yes.
So then me and him almost got into a fight. But it was a great show. That was another one.
So let's talk about your relationship with Wyclef, because you guys had a sort of like a relationship.
Yeah, in the early years, I was one of the first guys to work with Wyclef. And I did some of his private parties up here. When he came out with the Carnival album, I brought him to the Metropolis. The Metropolis, after that show, decided to ban all hip hop. Because it was so sold out. We had an extra 1,000 people outside. It always seemed like that. It was just, and people were fighting to get in because they couldn't get in because it was sold out. So they basically, by that time, Spectra, which is Andre Menard and these guys, had taken over the Metropolis.
Okay.
And I was dealing with a woman named Michelle Navarro, who was not sympathetic to hip hop, as opposed to the previous owners of the Metropolis, who just loved hip hop and opened the doors to us. And after that, I was basically, you know, banned from doing any hip hop in that room for many years, like many years.
Let's talk about your relationship with the Haitian community, because the Haitian community was a big part of your success.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times, the Haitian community was snubbed by the English community. What attracted you to working with Haitian promoters and opening the market to the Haitian community?
Well, it came a point, right, is that in the early days of hip hop, right, you had the black and whites were all in the same room together,
okay,
and joining. And then eventually you started to get white promoters who also loved hip hop, and they started to take that crowd away. And
mixed bring, crowd.
They started to take more of the white crowd,
okay,
that loved hip hop, and they started to bring them into other rooms and showcase them there. For whatever reasons, I won't go into it, but you know, they took them that way.
Okay.
So in order to embrace at that time in the late like 90s, in the 90s, this is when we started to become introduced to the Haitian community. Before that, we really didn't know them in the English. Because you had the English, right, which was basically of the English Caribbean islands, the Americans, the Scotians on that side. And then you had the Haitians who represented on the French side.
Yeah.
But we didn't really know them because they were just now starting to come of age.
Okay.
And starting to come out, come downtown, starting to participate in these events. So I saw an opportunity, being that I am biracial, and of trying to bring the different communities together, in particular that one, and, you know, bring their energy and their passion for music together with those who were already established in the market. So that's how I became involved within the Haitian community, starting to understand, appreciate their music and their passion for what they do.
But you were also one of the first English black guys to play on the Haitian basketball team, right?
Mm-hmm.
Immaculate Conception.
Yeah. I actually even played with one of the guys who ended up getting killed many years ago. He became a big mafioso guy in And then he used to be on my team, and we used to play together. And then I was one of the first guys, English guys, to go over there because I didn't get along with the little Burgundy coach. So I went over there, and I started to play. And that further introduced me into that community and allowed me to start to meet some of my earlier Haitian friends that, you know, also brought me further into it and started to show me their community and their world.
Okay. I'm going to open up the floor. Does anyone have any questions? Est-ce qu'il y a des questions? You can come use my mic if you have a question, or you can stand up and talk loud. Anyone have a question for Ricky Dean? Stand up and talk loud, big man.
Hey. Just before I see them.
So, yeah, what's your name?
Mackie.
Hey, Mackie, how you doing?
I met you a long time ago.
All right.
Yeah, at this thing called Tony XL. It was a dance thing.
Okay.
And you told me who you were, and I didn't believe you. You're like, I interviewed Snoop Dogg and everything. I'm like, liar. I just want to say that.
I appreciate that.
How was it to get Travis Scott here? Because that was...
Okay, so let me talk a little bit about, you know, I'm just going to talk a little bit about me and how I am. And, you know, we talked a lot about the early days of hip-hop, the golden age of hip-hop. You know, I talked about some of the shows that I produced there. You know, I went on to produce shows like Massive Attack, Mochiba. I was doing a lot of the, what we called back then, the UK Soul. We were with Acid Jazz. Was another name of that. I brought people like Guru. I brought all these shows. And then I eventually, I was one of the guys who started off with a lot of the hip-hop brands. So Cross Colors, FUBU, Echo, Rock Aware, all of these have to pay tribute to me. And I helped establish places like City Styles was one of the early stores that I worked with.
Sports Fever.
Right. City Style started in 1988. And being that I was from Little Burgundy and downtown was a natural extension for me, I needed a place to sell my tickets for my events. So I went to City Styles at first. They used to be on Stanley Street. And they used to sell my tickets for me. And by doing that, I started bringing people into the room because we would drive everybody to these ticket outlets to buy tickets. And then from there, I went to City Styles, moved over to Crescent Street. They closed down. Then I went to Sports Fever. Some of these people here might know that place. And then from there, I helped them to build their place. Then I went to Vibes, which was another hip-hop, more fully hip-hop.
You made them a lot of money, Ricky D.
Yeah, well, you know, I was young. I didn't know what was going on, but that was cool. You know, that was just in the moment, right? Like I said, we didn't have mentors. We didn't have people that taught us how the game really works. So we ended up getting exploited in a lot of ways, being that we were young and a lot of energy. But that's life. You learn. Hopefully, as you get older now, some of you's in here, you know, try to find that advice, whether the advice works for you or not, right? So then I went from there, and I opened up a store called Off the Hook. And it was me and my, it was me, Perry, a guy named Perry Janis. He was from Laval, he was Greek. And I met him through Gary T. Because him and Gary T were the originators of the Public Enemy show in 1988. Because Gary was putting offers in on the business of getting Public Enemy, and so was Perry. So the agent put them two guys together. Which then Gary said, hey, I got this guy, he's a hot shot, he's doing this thing, Ricky D. You want him? Perry's like, okay, bring him in. He has some money? Bring him in. Let's do this. So then we all started doing it together. Perry had a love of hip-hop, loved the business. He didn't really go out and participate in it. He was kind of clueless on some of the artists, but he had a desire for it, which was critical. He did all the phone calls. We gave him all the intel, what was hot, what was not, what we should be doing in terms of the shows that we needed to do. So we just continued to build. We then had Off the Hook. We opened the first one in the South Shore. We brought Razal there. I did it with a guy named Harry and Perry. And Harry used to be a waiter.
Busboy.
No, Angelo was the busboy. Harry was the waiter. No, Harry was the waiter at Over the Limit. I'm telling you. I'm telling you, I was there. I see. Harry was the waiter, and Angela was the busboy. And then we did the store together.
So that's the store on the South Shore.
That's the store on the South Shore. We opened this up behind Champlain Mall. We had it for a minute. I thought it was a bad location, but I went with my guys. So we did that for a minute, and then we opened downtown, where it's at presently today. And by that time, Rhonda and them were freaking out from Vibes with Fever, and Frank was freaking out because they knew the strength of me. So then we opened the store. A lot of the clothing companies didn't want to give us any clothing.
Yeah,
why? Because, you know, these guys were putting the leverage. They knew what I was capable, and they didn't really want to see anybody of color do it, right? They didn't want any, you know, they were happy to exploit my talents and my sweat equity, but they weren't ready to pay me properly for it. So by that time, I said, you know, I'm going to do this with Harry. I'm going to do this with Perry. We opened the downtown store. Angelo was the sort of like the franchisee. And he had the majority of the shares, and then we all piggybacked on the other shares. And they didn't want to sell us any clothes, so then I had a few meetings with them and went to their office, and in particular Rockaware, and I told them straight up, I said, listen, do you know where my office is? They said, where's your office? So I said to them, my office is on St. Catherine Street. You know where it is on St. Catherine Street? They said, where's your office? I said, you walk up and down that street. That's my office.
Right.
Okay? So while you're sleeping, I'm working.
Right.
And when you're awake, I'm working. So what's up? Are you going to give me these clothes that I put in there so you guys can make that money that you're all driving around with? Or am I gonna go on the street and dog the shit out of your clothes? So what are you gonna do now? You got a choice. They said, okay, you can have the clothes. So we ended up getting the clothes. You know what I mean? Like, I had to take it to that level with them because I knew it was going. So, you know, some tried to fight us, but a lot didn't because they realized who was the guy behind it. So that was good. So we did the store. You know, the store was going well. We ended up opening one in the West Island. By that time, I was less interested in it. I moved on. I was just about to have my first child in 2000. And it wasn't going anywhere. And I decided to remove myself from the business, which then Harry and Angelo continued. And built it into the successful brand that it is today, which I give them the respect. Perry left also, and we all moved on to other projects in our life.
So let's also continue about the entrepreneurship side of you, because at one point you also opened up a Domino's Pizza.
Right.
So what urged you to push and open up a Domino's Pizza, from being a concert promoter and open up a Domino's Pizza?
It's how it worked with me is that the key was confidence. The key was to believe in myself and everything that I did around me. And one thing led to another. I wanted to build something a little bit more solid for my family. And that's why I decided to open the Domino's. How it came about, the Domino's, was one day we were living in Chateauguay with my soon-to-be wife. And my son wanted to eat Domino pizza. Because living in Burgundy, we had Domino Pizza.
Yeah, we had Domino.
Right? So he was like, Daddy, is there any Domino's? I'm like, no, there's none. And I saw an opportunity, and I moved on. And I opened Domino's, and, you know, I had it for like 5 years. And then I sold it because, you know, the recession that came about, it was very tough in Chateauguay. There's a lot of racism in Chateauguay. A lot of white people didn't want to buy from me, because they saw that I was black, and when they found out that I was an owner, right, because they don't see biracial, they just see, oh, that's a black guy. And then when they saw my family, they were like, yo, for sure, B, that's what he is. And then, and then he come, right? But luckily, I had Ganawagi, and the natives there, they loved me.
Shout out to the natives.
Yeah, they loved me. They ordered something big, and they kept me alive while I tried to figure my exit plan, because I said, yo, this ain't happening. I got to get out of this. So that I built it, and I sold and got out. And I had a peace of mind after. I was like,
it was a tough part.
It was cool because I learned a lot of things. I don't regret it.
It was stressful though.
It was very stressful, and when you go into those small markets like that, you got to be very careful, because if for some reason they ain't feeling you, no matter what your brand is, you in trouble.
Let's talk about the racism and prejudice that we have in the city, being a promoter. That one time, if y'all didn't know, being a visible minority and a black person, you weren't allowed to really go to clubs on St. Laurent Street unless you knew somebody or if you hung with a crew. So talk us about the encounters that you have with club owners that refuse to do black parties, and also we're getting pressure from the police and the Régie d'Alcool.
So at one time, when it happened with that, is that it was really tough.
Yeah, tough.
I couldn't believe, racism, institutionalized racism, and everything exists in this city. This city, as beautiful as it may be, there's not too many opportunities for black people, especially black Anglophones, in this city to excel. And this city has a bad record of taking care of their own. You go to New York, you see guys like Kool Herc. You go to New York, you see guys like Grandmaster Flash. You see all these guys who invested into this city, into New York, into hip-hop, and they're taken care of.
And they get the respect.
They're taken care of, and they get the respect. Okay? Montreal, unfortunately, is a hypocritical city. You have a lot of, individuals who pretend to be your friends, but they're not your friends. They don't care about you. They don't care what you stand for. They don't care whatever. You know what I mean? They just want to see an opportunity. And that's cool. You know what I mean? I have no problems with that, right? But it's not a city that looks kindly to black entrepreneurship. It's not a city that embraces it. And you see it all the time. You can be a black owner of a business and open your doors to the public, and the public won't come in, and then you go next door and you'll see, a white person next door do their thing, and they'll be full. And you'll be wondering, well, why is that? What am I doing that they're not? So when it comes to people like Kool Herc and them, black and whites in America, it's all about, what can you do for me?
Exactly.
How can we build and make money? How can we break bread? It's not about, do you look like me? Do you talk like me? Do you act like me? You find that, and it's prevalent here, and you see guys like the Gregory Charleses and of the world here who are basically pandering in order to have an identity, because they're so desperate to utilize their skills that they end up losing the true essence of themselves.
Yeah.
And it's bad. You have to really know yourself, and you have to stand. Sometimes by doing that, you can alienate yourself, because you become maybe the hostile black man or the hostile woman. And it shouldn't be that. It's just, some people are a little more serious about what they do as opposed to other people. And you see this every day, which shouldn't be, When you've invested so much, there should be somebody there to give you that opportunity and not ignore you. It's like that out of mind, out of sight. And I hate to use these analogies because I see this every day, right? It's a classic example of playing basketball, and I can use that because sports is a microcosm of life. So you're playing in a game, you're extremely talented, yet they won't give you the ball. because when they give you the ball, you score or you make something good come out of them giving you the ball, even though you're in perfect position to help the team. So, and when they're forced to, they'll ought to give it to you out of that sweet zone. They'll give it to you too low, too high, to the side, to the back. So now you have to sit up there and work extra hard to make it happen. And when you do make it happen, then they discount it as a fluke. And then they sit up there and they force you to do it again and again and again and again. And then they might start passing you the ball. But if you don't buy into that, then what ends up happening, you will never get that ball. Because that's what they want to do. So either then you got to go out there and build your own team. You know, and unfortunately, you don't have a lot of venture capitalists here that are into it like they are in America, where they will give you that shot, where guys will come and say, you know, like how Puff Daddy did it. Puff Daddy started, he was doing parties at Howard University.
It's like you.
And then he went and he found the Mary J. Blige's and all of them. Well, I knew the Mary J. Blige's. I knew the Jodeci's of then. I knew these people here in Montreal. Fortunately, there was no platform for them. And there was no opportunities in order to develop that. So what ends up happening, you become stagnant. You hit that ceiling. And you can't excel anymore. So you have to either become patient or you wait.
So you've been extremely, extremely patient. Why not take your talent to Toronto or to America?
Well, you know, first of all, it wasn't as easy to do that. Being that I was an only child, I was bounded by my fear of going to these areas and starting alone. I didn't have that kind of like strength to do that. And I'm happy I didn't, because, you know, if I would have went at that time, I wouldn't have met my future wife, I wouldn't have my kids, and so forth. So I'm happy to have that opportunity here. Fortunately, you know, to go to Toronto now is ridiculous at my age to do that. So I do with what I have to do with now to succeed, and I continue to work on my craft and find shows. Now, hip-hop, you know, the golden age of hip-hop was fantastic. There was a lot of amazing shows. We did a lot of amazing things. Eventually, the music started to get taken away from us. When I say us, I'm talking about those who are true to the music. And it started to become pop. To now, I can hardly even get any shows anymore, because I'm fighting the Venkos, I'm fighting the Neons of the world here, who at one time didn't want to do anything with hip-hop because it was too volatile. So guys like myself took the hits, took the fights, took the stabbings, took the stuff shots, took the losses, took the drama, cleaned up the business, got to know our people, developed relationship with the troublemakers so we can neutralize them, basically clean hip-hop up. Now, hip-hop is one of the most viable music genres out there right now that is dominating a lot of the charts.
Yes.
So, you know, the life of an independent promoter in this city is slowly disappearing.
So let's talk about that, the Evencos and the big boys. When was the first time, before Evenco, there was DKD, right?
Yeah.
When was the first time that you saw them penetrating the hip-hop market?
Well, they've always dabbled with it, you know, with DKD back then. I remember Donald K. Donald had hired me in 1988-89 to promote Luther Vandross at the Montreal Forum.
Okay.
We did it at one time, myself, Perry, and Gary, and Alex Toby from Front Row. We had at one moment the biggest hip-hop show ever in Montreal. We did it at the Bell Center.
What show was that?
It was called Massive Groove, and we did it with the Fugees, Tribe Called Quest, and Cypress Hill. And we did 11,000 people. We financed the show. Donald K. Donald didn't have anything to do with it other than he controlled the building. So, you know, that was like one of my few times I actually went into the Bell Center, Molson Center back
expensive,
then.
Expensive, though.
Oh, it was super expensive. He basically took control of the show and caused us to go from an $80,000 profit, and within 24 hours of the show, we had broke even.
Crazy.
Just like that, and he didn't have the approval to do that. I remember Gary T wanted to beat up this old man. The man was walking with a kid. Yeah, just leave him alone, man. Gary was going crazy. Going crazy in the back, backstage. Like, how could you go and do this without us? It's, you know, it was terrible. So that was one of the times. And then, just recently, Evanko's increased their presence in hip-hop. They've increased it more. You know, it's business. You know, I don't blame them. You know, you have a big organization and you have a big team and you own four venues now, where before all you had was the Bell Center.
Now, what venues do they have now?
They own the Metropolis.
Okay.
They own Corona. They own the Bell Center and they own Castro.
So how do you survive with all this competition?
Well, you know, good thing about me, right? I've learned to be, you know, cockroaches lasted 200 million years. So it's very hard to get rid of a guy like me, because I always find a will as long as I have the way and the desire. So I will always get something. The difference is, do I feel comfortable in taking a crumb, or should I get a slice of that bread? Mm-hmm. That's where my attitude has to adjust. Mm-hmm. I went from basically building, you know, making this beautiful cake, I got a little piece of it. You know what I mean? And that's kind of, it's messed up on that level, but it's business. I'm people have to understand it's show business. And a lot of times, you know, people do these shows, and I want to talk a bit about the shows and how to do a show for some enterprise and promoters who want to get involved in this. So
let's talk about it. How do you put a show together?
Well, you know, the way I do it is the way I've been doing it. Things have changed now because of social media a bit, but I would look to see what artists are relevant at that time, whether they're charting, DJs are playing their records, if they're a new artist, or, you know, what impact do I think they'll have here? Back in the day, we would go to the record labels, and we would ask them, you know, how many records they sold. You know, how many vinyls, how many cassettes, how many CDs. And that would give us an indicator of if they were relevant or not.
Okay.
Then we would approach an agent, a booking agent. Okay, the booking agents are basically responsible for you to book these artists in those different markets.
So now, I know back
different
in the
cities, you know.
Back in the days before, you were dealing with booking agents more in the U.S., but now you're dealing also with Canadian booking agents, right?
Yeah, you know, the Canadian booking agents now are getting a little bit more aggressive, and, you know, and a lot of the American companies now are opening Canadian booking agencies in Toronto.
Okay.
But I don't deal a lot with them, per se, unless I have to. I continue to deal with the American ones.
Okay, so once you contact the agent, what happens then?
So when I contact the agent, if they take my call, sometimes they don't take your call, you gotta call them multiple times. So don't get discouraged if you call and you call 10 times and they don't answer. Call that 11th, call that 12th. Call until you get through. Eventually, you'll get to know the secretary or the assistant. They'll see, and if they like you and they like your vibe, they won't put the call through. That's the one thing about down there in the States, is that they like the underdog and they like the guy who's willing to put the work in. So even if the guy's super busy or the lady's super busy, eventually you will get through if you persevere. And you're persistent. You know, persistence overcomes resistance in that business. So you need to be persistent. So once you get them, you talk to them, you ask them if this artist is about to go on tour,
Yeah.
And do you have any plans on? Sometimes they'll reveal it to you, sometimes they won't. It all depends on what their intentions are. If they say, yeah, we are, then you ask them things like, what kind of thing. It's a relationship there where it can go either way, right? You can either ask them about the capacity, what do you think they can do in the room. They'll ask me, they'll try to fish out information, they'll try to get an offer from me of what I think that artist might be worth so they can try to gauge the market. Sometimes they already know what they're going to do because of the different responses, and especially if that artist has already been on tour and they've saw different reactions in the market, then they will have an idea of what they want to do here. But they want to see how you feel about that. They try to gauge off of you.
Okay.
In order to, so then they'll look and, you know, you tell them, okay, well, I think it's a $20 ticket. You know, I think it could do 1,000 people. And then they'll look at the math and they'll say, okay, well, he's worth $10,000 in U.S. It's never in Canadian. It's always in American. Always.
You got to calculate that.
Yes, you got to calculate all of that. And that's where the business comes in. And then you have to send, if they agree and they like your offer, they send you a contract. You have to send in a 50% deposit. If you're big like a Venko, you send in 10%. But, you know, the small guys always get banged up. So, and then you put your money there, and then you go out and you promote the show.
Okay.
Now, if the show doesn't work, you take an L. Okay. If you cancel the show, you lose your deposit. So, you better know what you're doing.
Now, there's two ways artists make money. I know it's you pay them up front, a fee, but then there's another way where they take a split at the door. Explain that one.
Well, it's more of a back-end deal. It's called a back-end deal. What happens is that as the artist gains in popularity and the agent and management becomes confident, then the deals change. Like, artists are like a stock market, you know? I'll give you an example. Juicy J, who's, you know, 3-6 Mafia, won a Grammy a couple of years ago, brought him here to Montreal for $5,000. 6 months later, he was $45,000.
Because he won the Grammy?
No, he didn't win no Grammy. That was way back.
Okay.
This is like, that was before, that was way after the Grammys and all of that. Okay. But that's how the business goes. They can go up, and then they can go down. But mostly they go up. So a person like a Travis Scott will never deal with you at this stage because they get controlled by the majors. Live Nation works with Evenko, AEG, these are the big guys that control all of that. So then they lock these artists down, they do these deals where they advance a lot of money to them, and you lose them. And it's, you know, a guy like a Travis Scott, when I did him in Montreal, when I brought him here.
Okay, how long ago was this when you brought him?
About 2 years now, maybe, about that. Last year. And when I brought him last year, he was $10,000, and now he's like $150,000,
yeah.
$200,000. You know what I mean? So it's a totally different, this is mortgage money, bro.
Yeah, but now, are they doing the back-end deals?
There's, like I said, okay. The least popular you are, they take more what's called a flat deal. A flat deal is they pay you $10,000, whether I make money or not, it's on you. But they always want to know what you made. So that way, the next time that artist comes true, they will determine if they're going to do a flat deal with you or not again. Then you have what's called, it's called back-end deals. There's basically two of them. You have a promoter's profit, where you do what's called an 85-15 split with the guarantee. So the guarantee, like say for example, you paid Travis Scott $10,000. They want to see your whole budget. They want to see your gross. So say that the show grossed $100,000, the budget was $50,000, you had $50,000 left, well, then they allow you to take 15%, right, off the $50,000. Then whatever's left over, you split with the artist 85-15. So he gets 85 and you get another 15, plus his guarantee, which is already in the 50,000. So that's how it works. That's one. And then you get even worse deals than that. That where you can get like a Michael Jackson deal. Michael Jackson's 95.5 versus deal, no 15%. There's no promoter's profit. There's none of that. No, no, no. It's 5%.
That's it.
You know, there's some artists you get 90 versus deal 90%. So they take 90% of the gate. And these are artists, basically you're like rolling your money. You know, it's not like you have to worry about, oh man, I'm gonna lose my money. You know, no, you're gonna get your money. Because these artists are pretty much guaranteed to deliver in terms of bringing people into the room. The only thing you have to do is put the money up.
So another thing I want to touch on about concert promotion that I learned at a young age, I call it the Coolio effect. So I remember Ricky D brought me into the Coolio show. His video was playing all over Music Plus. His song was playing all over radio. We got the radios involved. They were playing commercials. And no one showed up.
Yeah, I coined that term, the Coolio effect. I remember that.
So nowadays, when you gauge how an artist will do in Montreal, to before, whether an artist did well in the U.S. or in Toronto, doesn't mean he's going to do well here. Is it the same thing?
Well, of course. You know, I just had a cancellation last week that I had to do for the Underachievers in Ottawa. They sold 47 tickets. I ended up losing $5,000 U.S. plus all my marketing that I invested into because they did 47 tickets. So if I was going to do this show, I would have maybe lost 10, 12,000. So, you know, where do you stop the bleeding, right? Do you chop it here or do you chop it down there? But you know what? You're going to bleed. So figure out what you want to do. And it's not a question of pride. It's not a question. It's just a question of economics. It just comes down to that. And it has to make sense. And I ended up, you know, doing that. And with the Coolio thing, you know, Coolio was, he was charting everywhere. He was top on the videos. He was top in radio. But the problem with Coolio here is that basically you had two communities. You had the black community and the white community. White community thought he was too volatile, so therefore they didn't want to come. The black community thought he was too soft, so they didn't come. So both of them canceled out each other, and we were sitting there with an empty room. And I think after that show was the last show you decided to
come. I know.
You know, for me,
it's crazy because you know a lot of people don't know, but you know, like sometimes you got to put out money like for 5 shows up front, and you got to live, and then you're losing money, you're winning money. Talk us also about agents that force you to take shows.
Oh, I remember one time I got, what was the show now that I got that? It was with Everlast and that guy Surge something. He's a heavy metal guy.
Heineken.
Huh?
Surge Heineken.
Yeah, what's his group?
System of a Down.
Okay.
Well, I got System of a Down. I knew nothing about them.
Okay.
And the agent started screaming on the phone, said, "Take the show! It's going to sell out! Take it!" And we're like, well, me and Gary were sitting there like going, who's this guy? You know Everlast, right? Because of House of Pain and everything. And he was like the precursor to Eminem. It was, you know, him, and then Eminem came out. Eminem sort of kind of took his slot. But he was that guy being set up on that level there. And we got that show. We had no clue. The agent screamed at us, said, "Take it." And we took the show and we sold it out.
Wow.
And I had no clue. I didn't even stay for it because I didn't know what that music was. I stayed for Eminem. And then I heard it and I was like, yo, what's this?
Yeah, Forever Last.
Yeah, Forever Last. It showed me Forever Last. Well, I also did Eminem also. Right. I brought Eminem here the first time. Mad shout out to Gary T again, to Perry, to 514, to Daniel and them. And we did at University of Montreal. And it was a fantastic show.
Yeah, yeah, I remember that show. I was hosting that show.
My partners were scared. He didn't want to take no pictures with nobody but me.
I got a picture of him in proof.
Yeah, you must have got one in, at Off the Hook when you went to Off
no,
the Hook.
No, I got one that day.
Oh, you remember
then. Eminem, he had canceled all the interviews.
Exactly.
And I was there anyways hosting the show. And then at the end, the record label says,
He was cool, man.
Came Malik. I was ready for your interview. I just ran backstage, did my interview. Got my picture with proof.
Nobody else got it.
That was one of the first ever interviews.
Pumped off all my partners. Yeah. Pumped off my partners and everything. Like
first interview in
It was a trip, you know? So, you know, I had a lot of great memories. I remember one time with Naughty by Nature and Tretch and Gary T were fighting in the hotel lobby. And I had to break that up. Trench talk because he was a big boy that he was going to push up on Gary. And let me tell you, that was a battle royale right there if there was ever one.
Remember Trench took all that clothes and promised the... What happened was, these guys had brought down Trench from Light by Nature to do a show. And they brought him up to go get some clothes. And Trench took boxes of clothes... And promised the man that he's going to be on. What show was it?
I can't remember, man.
It was a late night show. He promised he's going to be wearing the clothes. Trench never wore the clothes.
Well, Eminem did the same thing. Came to Off the Hook and he cleaned it up. He cleaned out Off the Hook also and came up there in the early days. So there was, you know, these are some of the things. So now I sit up there and I look at the future of hip hop.
What's the future, Rick?
And I see the present and I see the future. You know, basically, now it's about really choosing the right artists. Now it's harder to take the chances because there's a lot of hit and misses. And if you don't get the artists at the right amount, you can lose a lot of money.
But then you have a lot of young rookies that are overbidding.
Yes. But you know, you can never. Unfortunately, it's a business that's not unionized. You don't need a license. Anybody with a bag of money can step in there and do what they got to do, which is great because you know it's open. It's as open as it can be. So it gives great opportunities if you know what you're doing, and you're disciplined and focused. Then you can succeed and you can last as long as I have.
Let's talk about the relationship with Wu-Tang.
Oh, Wu-Tang.
Wu-Tang is special. Remember the show? We had this event, the show, they had done a soundtrack for a movie. And we were the sellout. Yeah. And then something happened in, what was it, Virginia or something?
Yeah.
And they're on the run. So they couldn't come to Canada. We lost our money again. I got stung.
Yeah, and then I worked on them, and then a couple of years ago, I was able to bring up some of the members of Wu-Tang, and that was a disaster. Like it was,
they don't really talk to each other either.
Yeah, it was really bad. It was like one of the Wu-Tang has a lot of beefs within the organization. A lot of them don't like RZA and RZA's brother because they feel that, you know, like, I'll give you an example. When Method Man and Raekwon and Ghostface does a show, they have to pay royalties to Wu-Tang, to the brothers. And yet they feel that they all built Wu-Tang together. Sure. But because they were young and naive, they didn't understand the business side, and these guys exploited that, and therefore ended up owning the brand. Like you see the Wu-Tang logo was done by a guy named DJ Mathematics.
Yeah.
So the DJ, he designed that logo, which is almost as iconic as, say, Apple.
Yeah, Apple.
Right?
Yeah.
And yet, he receives no royalties from that. Yeah. But because he's you know, he DJs for them, they give him DJ gigs, and, you know, he's taken care of, but he's not taken care of the way he's supposed to.
Yeah.
So they had a lot of beef between each other, and what happened the last Wu-Tang show, a buddy of mine booked the show, paid them $25,000. They ran a game where they said, yeah, you can book the Wu-Tang Clan, but you're booking the name of the Wu-Tang Clan. Doesn't mean that the artists within the Wu-Tang Clan will show up. Mm-hmm. Right? So they tried to sell us that. Well, they sold it to him, and then he came to me, and I said, what? So there was no Method Man, there was no Ghostface, there was only Inspector Deng, was some of the guys that, no, not the key guys,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
So the hustle, somebody, the hustle. I'm like, you sent this guy $25,000 US, and you didn't do your homework. You know, it's the guy from Olympia. He was like, oh, Ricky.
He doesn't know about him, right?
So I'm like, all right, cool. This is what we're going to do. I'm going to go. I'm going to individually contract each artist, and I'm going to pay them directly. That 25 grand that homie got there, the agent, he's going to take a portion of that, and he's going to give it to
each artist.
Money. Okay? So I was able to neutralize his money. And then I went and I got each artist individually, contracted them out, paid them directly, and that's how I was able to get my show. Which then, the RZA and them called me and basically said, you know, that's effed up what you did. And I said to them, no, that's effed up what you did. And I said, I got you. He never talked to me. He never talked to me after that, right? And then we did the show. It was a huge ice storm in Montreal and in New York. I got most of the guys, but I didn't get Method. But I paid Method $25,000 in advance because he wasn't going to come without that. So now he has my money. He doesn't show up to that show, but he shows up to the Toronto show the next day because Toronto didn't have the ice storm, right? So he owes me a show, right? I paid the guy the money. Yeah, I'm going to give you the show. Calling, this and that. We're working out the dates. That's what they're saying to me. No show's coming, right?
Got your money.
So now you got my money, right? So he thinks that I'm stupid now. I'm going to leave it up there. And then Patrick, partner at Olympia, said, what are we going to do? I said, don't worry, we're going to get them. So now Redman is going on tour. So I said to Red and them, yo, I'll give you extra money if you bring down Method. So he said, okay. So I gave him $5,000 more than what he was supposed to get for that show.
He's happy.
Now I go and I promote Method and Red. Now Method's mad. Because now Method can't screw his boy. So he has to come. Yeah. So he comes and he's talking to me, I'm on the phone, okay. And the Patrick looks at me and says, brilliant move. Got him on the stage, they did the show, get that done.
Yeah.
So that's how I was able to get it back. But anybody else would have lost that money.
Yeah. That's the rickety hustle.
But that's street knowledge. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's understanding what you're dealing with and understanding the knowledge. You know what I mean? Because most people would have just gave up on that 25 and call it a day, you know?
Not like, Ricky Dean.
No, I don't know. That's for my family. You're crazy. I got a family. I can't let that go down.
Ricky Dean wants his Megan.
Yeah, absolutely. Megan. So, you know, this is part of it. You know, a lot of people in Montreal, the days have changed, you know? The days of entitlements is over. We have to all work together to fill these rooms. Back in the day, I wouldn't need an opening act to sell a ticket. I wouldn't need an opening act. But I give these opening acts an opportunity to get on stage because the Avencos and the Neons and all of these other cats never put on opening acts.
Jones.
They only put you on when you reach a certain plateau, if you're like Hart Street or you're Kate Trenanda or something like that, where they can see there's a and the potential to exploit you. But if you're not anything, they're not even going to look at you. So, but at the same token, right, they have the money that if they do take a hit, they can survive the hits. With me, you know, I work at the hospital still. I've been there since 1988. Same time I started CKUT.
Yeah.
I started CKUT in 1988. I got in the show. I was going to McGill. It was my first year at McGill. And my buddy Fabian at that time wanted a show on there because you had a popular hip-hop show called the Sound Supreme Show. And he wanted the show, and I ended up being the first late night show at CKUT, because CKUT used to stop at 12 midnight. 12 to like maybe 6 or 7 in the morning or 7 in the morning. They had no program.
So your show, just let people know, your show is called Sound of Soul. It's basically Monday at midnight.
Monday morning
at midnight.
At midnight. And but originally, I had the choice of whatever time slot I wanted after midnight. I had the choice of that. And I took Sunday mornings because at that time, Fabian and myself, Fabian was playing in a club called Business, and he wanted to do an open late night thing after the clubs when you're driving home. You could listen to him play. So I went in, and I was playing the cassettes until he arrived after the show. We started from 2 to 7.
Oh, really?
Yeah, 2 in the morning to 7 in the morning. And eventually, Fabian started to feed. Right? You know, oh, here's the cassettes. You go in. And they would never show up. So I'm there now playing the cassettes and learning the thing. And then I ended up hitting this show with him and a guy named Sean Clark and another guy named Jeff.
Okay.
Jeffrey Rhodes. And they were the host. And then they got into a huge fight. They had, this one guy had two like girlfriends show up at the station at the same time. So it was a battle royale in there. Records were flying all over the place. So then they called me on the Monday CKUT and they said, listen, we're about to can this show. And I said, well, I wasn't there. I was sick. Thank God I wasn't there. I was sick. Had the flu.
Yeah.
So that saved the show. So then all of them were gone. Fabian basically was starting to remove himself because I guess he didn't want to be in the late night anymore. So I started to take over the show. But he would supply the music. And then at the end of the, going towards 6 or 7 in the morning, I was playing slow music. Right? And then after that, I did that for a couple of years while I was at McGill. And then I gave it to a guy named Tony DeCiprius.
Okay.
We did this thing called Utopia Paradise. He continued. And I continued that for many years. After that, I then moved over to the Sunday. And I was doing my show on the Sunday.
You still have your show, Sound of Soul?
Yeah, I do every second week. I have DJ V-Mind and Tash for the last maybe 5 years. I'm tired.
Yeah,
he's
tired.
I can't get up every, you know. I love it, and that's why I continue. And it's a great opportunity to play some great music and give people an opportunity to hear some good R&B, which is very hard to find on radio these days. Well, it's always been the case. Hip-hop, reggae, there's a ton of it. If you're talking R&B, talking slow jams, talking soul music, hard to find.
So you've been on CKT for 29 years, right?
About that, since 1988.
Give him a hand. 29 years. And he's volunteering people. He doesn't get paid. He's volunteering his time to get up there. Let's talk about the influence that CKT had on hip-hop and urban music in Montreal.
Huge.
Let's talk about it.
Huge, huge. Like, they were, other than AM, Club 980, which Butcher T started off, thank God for him, you know. It was huge because eventually AM started to fade. You know, poor quality, spotty to get, and FM started to develop in the mid-80s. And CKUT was there at that moment because commercial radio wasn't giving us any opportunities. They still don't to this day. I mean, now and then they might have dabbled a little bit here and there. You know, they used to do their 15 minutes of, I'm like, yo, what's that? You know, that kind of retarded stuff. But CKT was critical because it was the first station that spawned all these other community stations that you have today in the city that play that type of music.
True.
Because there was no outlet for that. There was, you know, like, where were you able to hear it? Either in the clubs, at a Blocko. Blocko was like music in the park. People used to set up, you know, speakers or DJs, and they used to play in the park. Or people's ghetto blasters, huge tape recorders, which they had recorded music when they went to New York. Or they bought cassettes from the local record stores here that had them. So it was, you know, that's just the way it went, you know.
But at one point, you needed, you know, when you were doing parties, you had to have a commercial running on CKUT.
Yeah, well, you know, listen, we needed to support the station. The station was supporting us. They were giving us a vehicle in order for us to drive. You know, unfortunately, we weren't able to graduate. You know, at one time, there was a lot of creative struggle going into CKUT because, you know, the music that we represented was just so popular. It was just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So the demands became greater and greater. But, you know, CKUT was able to hold its uniqueness by, you know, offering other fledgling musics a platform, which, you know, when I think about it now, was very courageous of them, because at that time, the wave was real, you know. They were going to get overwhelmed by hip-hop, urban music, and all these other smaller independent sounds would have never been heard or ceased to have a platform, you know. Just like hip-hop was one of those, but, you know, eventually grew bigger and bigger every day, you know what I mean?
I also want to send a big shout-out to Louise Burns, because she's always been behind urban music.
And there are a lot of guys.
Yeah. Always open-minded, and we appreciate that.
You know, so, you know, CKUT was there, and, you know, from there you had the CINQ, the CISMs, CIBLs, you know, all these other stations started to come out, the K103s, you know, all these stations came and almost spawned off of that station. That station helped to bring the music to the masses in the city. You know, obviously with social media now and your ability to listen worldwide, you know, it's lost its importance on that level, but it's still relevant in terms of the platform is still there for those who want to listen. Where, you know, at one time, it was everything.
Yeah.
You know, now with, you know, the future of hip-hop now and where it's going, you know, we're becoming so heavily dependent on social media that we're literally becoming slaves of it. And, you know, a lot of people are starting to get turned off of social media because they realize how it's taken away other creative elements. You know, we've lost local radio, in my opinion. We lost newspapers, you know, which at one time I used to enjoy picking up a bunch of Montreal Mirror, Au Revoir, and checking out the ads, checking out the articles. You know, we've lost that. We've become an environment where we post something on social media hoping that we get 5 likes. And it's sad, it's pathetic. And then you have all these other people that haven't really put any kind of investment into it, who think that they understand how to promote it.
Oh, yeah.
They'll go and they got, you know, 200 friends or 1,000 friends, and all of a sudden now they're promoters. And,
yeah, a lot of stuff.
But they won't go and they won't hand out a flyer. They won't go and meet their people. They won't do anything of that nature. They just become hidden behind the clique. and they think that that's all it takes in order to be successful in that. Unfortunately, a lot of them are getting banged out in the equation because they're not interested in, you know, taking it to that next level and going out there and putting a real investment into their product.
Okay. So listen, Rick, we only have 20 minutes left.
Okay.
I want to take some questions or some comments. Do you have a question?
I have a question.
Stand up. Let's talk a little louder. Your name, please.
Sure. My name's Shree.
How you doing, Shree?
Hey. So thank you so much. This has been really exciting.
Thank you.
And I was listening to you talk about Evenco and these people coming in, and I'm wondering whether you have any artists from before that still feel loyal to you, and whether they do feel kind of more committed to community than to going with a group like Evenco. Has the music industry changed so much and the setup changed so much that even if they do feel that loyalty or that sense of community that's more important to them, can they still kind of work with you rather than with these other people? Is that even possible? So I'm just wondering how it's set up these days and if you've got artists like that.
Well, if you're talking from a local perspective, they have no choice but to work with me. Because it's either me or nothing. Because they will not get a platform whatsoever. And if you look at models of Evenco and everything, me, I'm hip-hop. So I'll mess with the metal rap, I'll mess with the underground rap, I'll mess with the pop rap, I'm going to mess with them all. Them, they have a certain box. And if you fit in that box, you're good. But that box is not big. So they're like more of the hipster guys, the ones with the skinny jeans. They don't like the guys who are kind of a little bit more rugged in their demeanor, that are lyrically inclined. They're looking for a clean, generic, sanitized look. And that's pretty much what they like. I, on the other hand, like them all. I like them all. I just do. You know, I will listen to, you know, a Smoke Perp, which is a new artist, and then I'll go and I'll listen to a Biggie, or I'll go and I'll listen to a Big Daddy Kane, or a House of Pain. And I just don't listen to black artists, I listen to white artists. I'll listen to an Arabic artist, as long as I understand what they're saying. You know, I'll listen to it, right? So that's the difference. They don't give the opportunities to them. Well, I do, but unfortunately, I don't have the marketing means and muscle that I don't need the support of the local artists to go out there and bring people, because I'll give an example. When I was growing up doing this business, I could have went to the colleges and handed out flyers. I could have went to the concerts, I could have went to the movies. Now you can't even go to the sejobs, you can't go to the universities anymore because of all the violence that's occurred. So they basically closed those doors. So you don't have those avenues anymore. So everything becomes email blasts, social media, you know, influencers. You know, influencers is the new thing now. You know, somebody builds up a certain amount of likes on their fan pages or whatever, and you know, you go to them and you either pay them or give them a ticket, and they in turn do that. But a lot of artists now don't have that. I'm one of the few guys that do, but there's a trade-off. It's not going to be, well, I'm going to put you on my show and you're not going to help me because I need your help. That's the difference. They don't need your help. They have the Canadians, they have that check coming in. They're cool. You know what I mean? Or me, I work at a hospital. You come and see me. That's where I was today. That's why I was late. Because at the end of the day, I got to feed my family. And it's all about that. I have no shame in my game. I go and I do what I got to do. If this promotion game would have taken care of me, you know, maybe I wouldn't even be here today, B. But God willing, I'm here because I put the sweat equity in on it. But that's how it works. And it's sad because some of these guys, truly deserve the opportunity to be on some of those stages, but they're not interested in doing it.
Do we have any questions or comments? Anyone who worked with Ricky D would like to make a comment? Yes, sir.
So, what is the biggest, most recent shows that you put on, and how was it to deal with the management and all that?
Well, what was the biggest? I did quite a few last year. This year, the biggest one was T.I. It was one of the biggest ones I did this year.
About that? Because I know one of the guys that opened, and did you pick the openers? Or?
Yeah, I, sometimes what we do with the openers, it all depends on their level. I have a thing of nothing is given, everything has to be earned. So if you're an opening act, an inspiring rapper, okay, or an artist, and you want to get on some of these stages, you need to build your base. You need to build your fan base so we can, because there's a cost, right? You go on that stage. When I go to a Club Soda or I go to Olympia, I got to pay rent. I got to pay security by the hour. I got to pay technicians by the hour. It gets very costly. So when you, and then, you know, if you're dealing with opening acts, and, you know, they have a rider, they want guest lists, they want to do a sound check, you know, it gets demanded. And then when you ask them to promote it on their page, you ask them to, they don't do it. They're lazy, they figure that they're owed something, when in fact, nobody owes you nothing. Because if that was the case, then I would literally have the keys to the city, and I'd be working at an event call or something like that. But as you can see, there's no level of entitlement. You have to go out there and earn whatever you're supposed to get, whether it's with them or without them. So you as a, if you're an up-and-coming artist and you want to get out there, build your fan base. Because when you build your fan base, that's when you have power. And when you have power, you can get a lot faster than when you don't, looking for favors. And that's the difference. That's the difference between a guy who wants a favor with power and a guy who has no power but wants a favor. There's a difference on that.
Thank you.
Did I answer it?
One part.
Okay, what is the other part?
The T.I. How did you get T.I.?
How did I get T.I.? Yeah. The same way I just told you before. Phone calls, agents get to know you, they get to trust you, they know, because it's a trust game, right? They don't want to go and give you an artist that you're going to mess up, because then that burns them with the artist and their management, and they will never want to work with them again. So they have to make sure whoever they give the show to is capable of delivering the show the night of. If they think that you're not capable, then they're not going to give it to you. But you have different agents who have what I call, you know, different degrees, varying degrees of, you know, will they give it to you or not. If you go and you make some ridiculous offer that's like, you know, 50% higher than what they're receiving, well, let me tell you, they're going to give it to you. Will you deliver? They're going to hope and pray you do. But most of the time they won't, because they're scared that that one show might cost them maybe hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars in sales for the company that they represent, because that artist no longer wants to deal with them anymore. So, you know, the last few big shows I did last year, I did Rust, I did Flap with Zombies, I did Toy Lanes, I did Chronics, Major Gibbs from Paris. I Am. This year, Tech N9ne. I was going to do the Underachievers, but they didn't do well. I did this artist named Necro. I did this other artist named Jedi Mind Tricks. I can't remember all of them.
Freddie Gibbs.
Yeah, thank you. I can't remember all the shows. I do so many shows sometimes. But again, right, you have to keep working. And you got to make those phone calls. You got to be on them. Sometimes it's tiring to always make those phone calls and deal with it. But that's the nature of the business that we're in. And sometimes the agents will give you a show or two. Not all the time. Like now I'm trying to get Uzi Vert. I'm trying to get some of these new rappers, Lil Yachty. I'm trying to get some of these new guys. I'm working on a House of Pain show for the 20th anniversary. Black Dot from The Roots, working on him. So these are the kind of shows that I enjoy a lot. Necro, I enjoyed. It was a great show. He was a wonderful guy. Jedi Mind Tricks, same thing. I like to do more R&B, but it's, you know, right now, especially with the new R&B, like the SZAs and the Daniel Caesars and them, I can't get them because they're grabbing them. Well, at one time, these shows would have went to me. They would have went to me, I would have took them to a certain level, and then they would have took them over and moved it to the next level after that, because then by that time, I couldn't afford them. They go into, you know, more than 2,000 people capacity rooms, you know. When you're doing, like, say, 5,000 people, like a Kendrick Lamar is like a $350,000 artist plus a percentage of the gate, you know. Drake is like 2-3 million. Like, oh, yeah, it's retarded. You can't even, like, look at these guys. Just forget them. Just put them to the side and deal with the, you know, the new guys until they become unreachable.
So let's take another question. Any other questions?
We have a question from Facebook Live.
Facebook Live. Okay.
So it's what advice would you give to young artists doing their own promotion for their shows on the local Montreal scene as of now?
They have to put the work in. They have to go out there and meet the people. It's not just about having a great record. A great record does help, right? But there's a lot of artists now, with the advent of new technology, anybody can put out a great record, great sounding record. The difference is building your fan base locally. These people become your endorsable. Because you're only, in hip-hop, especially in hip-hop, you're only as good as your hood. That's why you see in hip-hop, everybody's always repping for it. I'm from Oriana. I'm from Little Burgundy. I'm from Brooklyn. I'm from Compton. Because it matters. You see? So, if you would have went and heard about Kendrick Lamar before he became that guy, and you would have went to Compton, somebody would have told you there that they rate him. Right? Because he put the work in locally before he went outside of his neighborhood. But you have to build your base here. You have to go out there and build them one by one, and then you have to organize them into a unit. And these are the people that are going to help you. When I was doing parties, I had a base at that time of 150 to 200 people. No matter what I did, what kind of parties, they were coming. Now I start grabbing this promoter, grabbing that, doing this concert, going to this location. I would go from 2 to 2,000 people. That's how real it was. But I knew I had that base. Obviously, my base has eroded a lot as a party promoter because I've gotten older. And the crowd that used to come up with me in colleges and universities are now the mothers and fathers. Some of them are grandparents. Some of them are great-grandparents. So, you know what I mean? So, you know, it's sad to say, but some of them are. But, and they just went to that next level. So, for all those out there, build your base. Have great music. Get it out there. But most importantly, you need to go and connect with the people who are going to support you.
All right. Any other questions or comments in the back?
Yes, Mr. Dean.
Yes.
First of all, thank you very much for keeping it real on the stage. You know, you're really letting it out. I'm feeling reserved.
I wanted to ask you a question about whether, while you were grinding on the beats, if you had a team with you, like if you had other human beings that were just as passionate about you that were working with you on a day-to-day, or you know, did they ever, some people fall off, or was you a one-man army while you were out there on the street?
I was a one-man army, and as I was on my journey, walking down the road, at certain points, I ran into people. Some of them fell off real fast. Some of them continued a little bit more, but none of them stayed the whole way. Because I was determined and I was passionate. You gotta remember, this gave me confidence. This gave me hope that I can be something more than what people thought I should be. So for me, this is what made me continue to do what I do. Nothing else. You know? So some people are in it for the money, some people are in it for the passion, some people are in it for both. I'm in it for both. I still enjoy getting up and taking something from nothing and building it into something that, you know, it's like I have, you know, no offense, sweetie, but I have multiple children that I've helped to create throughout the years. Some have gone on to be superstars. And some of them, you don't even know who they are, you know? But I helped mourn them all. And I've watched them come from nothing to something. Yeah, go ahead.
I would say that I'm a driven individual. I would say that, and I work with other persons that are equally driven, and we see each other at different times and different places. And I think a lot of when I think of promotions, I can only see where your head and your vision is going through my head, right? And I wanted to ask, like, what was the highest vision you have for? Not only just promoting the Montreal, putting on great events and allowing artists a platform to be able to shine and put Montreal forth, like let's say a Chicago or California or New York, what is it that you would want to see, what do you see if the right things are in place, and how would you add into that? What would you put into that?
I'm not sure I understand where you're going with that. Just say it one more time, but just...
You want to ask how does he unite the culture to be at that level like Chicago?
I apologize for not being clear. Basically, I'm saying, like, you've seen the promotion go up to where you are right now. I would say that you are the standard and that your work ethic for something to achieve, right? And for it to grow further than what you have brought on, is sometimes you live in a generation, you want a generation to bring out further than what you've done. What is your vision for that, and what would you do to help that to get there if you believe that you have any vision around this?
Well, I basically took hip hop to where I needed to take it to. I'm at the last leg of a relay race, a 4x4. So I got a few more moves in me before I hit that finish line. And, you know, and hopefully I will inspire other young individuals to carry it on in some way. It's not an easy business that I'm in. It's a whorish business. It's a business where some people are loyal, but most are not. But you have to just believe in yourself and believe in what you need to do and continue to carry the torch in one manner you can. Unfortunately, you know, I've tried to take on people throughout the years to mentor them, but I felt that the majority of them were just in it to get a number. You see what I mean? Like, they just wanted to get the artist's number. They wanted to get the manager's number. They wanted to get the agent's number. They weren't interested in really learning the business, but they were just interested in trying to bag a number so they think they can go ahead and do the show because they think they got to figure it out. So they haven't really put the work in. So when I start to see things like that, I just get rid of them. because they're not interested in putting the work in. Before I started making the calls, for many years, I trusted my partners back then to make those calls because I wasn't ready to make those calls. And once I established myself and I got myself into a position where I felt comfortable at doing it, because for whatever reason they decided they didn't want to do it anymore, they were uninterested, then I started making the calls. And still to this day, you know, I get a lot of shows that doesn't necessarily come from just me. I'll have somebody else call me, hey, Ricky, I got this show, you want to jump in? You know, it's like a small community of us. It's very small, but, you know, that are willing to take those risks because it's a very risky business. You have to have confidence, and you have to be able to evaluate what you're about to do. A lot of people go out there, they got stars in their eyes, but their feet are not on the ground. Or their feet is on the ground and they lack no imagination. So you need to be able to temper both and balance them. You got a little bit of both, but you can't be like this, you can't be like that. You got to be around the middle and let either one of them guide you depending on where you need to go.
So Ricky D, we got 60 seconds left. Do you have any last words?
Well, like I said, I thank you all for coming out. I appreciate CKUT for this. I was flattered and honored and a bit shy because, this business that I'm in, show business that I'm in, when I first started, I never thought it would take me this far. When I was going to university, it was more of a hobby. When I got out of the university, I didn't know what to do with myself. I was confused. And I went to what I knew, and that was this. And it's, you know, taken me this far throughout my life that I'm here at this moment where, you know, I feel that I had something to say, and CKUT recognized it. I'd like to thank you, Shahid, for being a part of my journey along the way, and you've been instrumental. He's been one of those guys who's not only a friend, but he's my little brother, and he's been there for me along the way doing his thing.
My pleasure.
You know? So, you know, and I appreciate everybody who's taking the time, you know, from some of my heroes, from Butcher T was, you know, being one of them, Gary T being another, Perry being another, Keith and Karen being another. You know, I've watched guys like Sterling Downey and these guys coming up, you know, bringing hip hop even further into the various communities and helping to ignite it. I've watched, you know, some of the DJs, like some of my favorite DJs right now for hip hop. He's one of them, Pro V. I listen to his show every week. He's super good. And I was happy when we had him on because he's one of my favorites because he just locks into that quintessential New York sound of hip hop, which to me is what I grew up on and it's what endears me the most. And, I thank my family, my daughter, my wife, my son was on. Unfortunately, my son is working at McDonald's. Imagine that, 17 years old, started at McDonald's, 15 and a half. He's working, he's going to school, and he's learning the ethics of putting in the work. Even though he doesn't really need to do it, we will take care of him. But he's putting in the work, and I got to give him that on that. Because he said, Dad, I got to work. I said, you're not going to come and hear me talk. He said, Dad, I hear you talk all the time. I said, okay.
So, Rick, we have one more question from one of your longtime fans.
All
right. I'm at Alan. What's going on, Alan?
Just a comment on the whole Sybil bit.
Yes.
You were wondering the year.
Okay.
And the year is '89 on Attic Records.
Okay.
And Champion Records if you're UK.
There you go. Oh, see, he knows better than I do. You know, I did like CC Peniston at that time. I was doing a lot of house music, Robin S. I was one of the first straight promoters to start doing things like KOX and the gay community with Robin S. I was fearless. You got to be fearless if you want to be in this business. Can't be stupid and go off a cliff, you know, because nobody can fly. But I was fearless. I went wherever I needed to go to get it done. And that's very important. And I hope that, you know, hip-hop continues, and I hope that if somebody in this room can continue it, or their friends can, and you can inspire them to continue, because at the end of the day, as much as the majors are coming into it, they're going to come a time where they're going to rinse it all through, like they've done with all the other music. They've done it with indie rock, they've done it with rock, they've done it with pop, now they're doing it with hip-hop. But it's going to come a time, they're going to get tired, and they're going to move on to the next flavor. And hopefully by that time, individuals like yourselves who put in the work will be able to get it back. They'll come back to those who are supposed to come, back to its home. Thank you very much.
I want to thank also Archive Montreal, Canadian Heritage, and CQT for making this event possible. Art Gang, thank you very much, Art Gang.
And Art Gang, yeah.
If you want more information on Ricky D, visit rickydevents.com.
rickydevents.com, R-I-C-K-E-Y, events with an S, .com.
All right, thank you, Ricky. Always a pleasure.